A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
93 decibels outside, 68 inside with the door closed. Broadband energy concentrated between 125 hertz and 2 kilohertz. That's the specific acoustic signature of hydraulic rock breaking vibrating through your walls, sitting 13 decibels above the WHO residential guideline. You can't hear yourself think, and you've got 12 months of lease left.
Here's what makes this genuinely different from ordinary city noise. You signed that lease before the excavation intensified. Now you're locked in, the jackhammers are going, and there's no practical exit. That feeling of being trapped? That's the exact psychological precondition the research identifies as a perfect storm for real distress.
We have a special prompt today from Marcus James. He's living this right now in Jerusalem, adjacent to a major construction site in the excavation and foundation stage. He took measurements, and what he's asking isn't about hearing protection or soundproofing. He wants to know what actually happens to your brain when you live with this for months, why intermittent jackhammering feels so much worse than constant noise, and whether there's anything evidence-based you can do when moving isn't an option.
Marcus, the fact that you measured this, that you're asking these specific questions, that already puts you ahead of where most people are when they reach out. Most people just say, "It's loud, and I'm losing my mind." You've given us numbers, a frequency range, and you frame the problem in terms of psychological resilience rather than just decibels. That's exactly the right way to think about this.
Let's start with what's actually happening inside your brain when that jackhammer hits for the 500th time. Because the neuroscience explains exactly why this feels like it's breaking something that isn't just your concentration.
The first thing to understand is that what Marcus is describing is what environmental health researchers call a compound stressor. It's noise plus unpredictability plus vibration plus the perception that you have no control over any of it. Each component hits different stress pathways. The acoustic energy triggers the auditory startle reflex. The unpredictability prevents your brain from ever learning to filter it out. The vibration, and at 125 hertz, that's exactly the range where walls resonate, means you feel it in your chest before you even consciously register the sound.
The control piece is the one that really gets people. You can close your window against traffic. You can ask your neighbor to turn down music. You cannot ask a hydraulic rock breaker to take a break because you have a conference call.
Seligman's work on learned helplessness maps directly onto this. When an organism perceives that an aversive stimulus is uncontrollable, the stress response doesn't just persist. You start bracing for the noise even during quiet periods. You stop trying to do things that might help because your brain has learned that effort doesn't matter. Marcus signed the lease before the work intensified. That's the perfect setup. You made a reasonable decision, circumstances changed, and now you're stuck. The brain interprets stuck as helpless.
Walk me through the actual neurobiology. What's happening moment to moment when that jackhammer fires up?
It starts with the orienting response, an ancient evolutionary circuit. When a sound changes unexpectedly, your brain instantly redirects attention to assess whether it's a threat. The auditory cortex processes the sound, but it also sends a direct signal to the amygdala, your threat detection center. The amygdala doesn't wait for conscious analysis. It triggers a cortisol release within milliseconds. Heart rate goes up. This is useful if the unexpected sound is a predator in the bushes. It's less useful when it's the 400th jackhammer burst of the morning.
Shouldn't your brain eventually figure out that the jackhammer isn't a threat and stop reacting?
That's exactly the question that makes this so interesting. And the answer is, it depends entirely on predictability. The brain habituates to stimuli when it can predict them. If a sound occurs at regular intervals or is continuous and unchanging, the orienting response diminishes. Your brain essentially says, "I know what this is, I don't need to keep checking." But intermittent, unpredictable noise, and jackhammering is the textbook example, prevents habituation entirely. Each burst is a fresh surprise. Each burst triggers a fresh cortisol spike.
It's not just that you don't get used to it. Your brain is actively prevented from getting used to it by the structure of the sound itself.
A 2019 study from Environmental Health Perspectives quantified this. They compared intermittent noise to continuous noise at the same average decibel level and found that intermittent noise caused 2 to 3 times more subjective annoyance. The mechanism, unpredictability, prevents the prefrontal cortex from down-regulating the amygdala's threat response. Normally, your prefrontal cortex sends inhibitory signals to the amygdala. Calm down, this isn't dangerous. But that regulatory circuit requires predictability to engage. When the noise is random, the prefrontal cortex can't get a grip.
You've got the amygdala firing over and over, and the part of your brain that's supposed to calm it down is just standing there with nothing to work with.
It gets worse. There's something called central sensitization, originally studied in chronic pain, but it applies to any repeated stressor. With chronic intermittent noise, the neural pathways for threat detection don't just fail to habituate. They actually become more sensitive over time. The synapses strengthen. The threshold for triggering the stress response drops. By month 3 or 4, you're reacting more strongly to the same noise than you did in week 1.
Which means you'll get used to it is not just unhelpful advice. It's biologically backwards.
A 2020 study tracked residents near construction sites over time and found that annoyance scores actually increased over the first 6 months before plateauing. That's the opposite of habituation. People weren't getting used to the noise. They were getting more sensitized to it.
There's another piece I want to pull out from Marcus's measurements. The indoor reading, 68 decibels. That's not just above the WHO guideline of 55. It's in the range where speech intelligibility starts to degrade.
This is a huge point. When background noise hits about 65 to 70 decibels, your brain has to work significantly harder to parse speech. You can still understand words, but you're using extra cognitive resources to do it. Researchers call this listening effort, a hidden tax. By the end of a day of intermittent construction noise, you've accumulated hours of this extra cognitive load. Your brain is burning glucose and oxygen on auditory processing that should be automatic.
That's before you even get to the work you're actually trying to do.
If you're trying to write, code, or think deeply, you're doing it with a brain that's already partially depleted from just processing conversation against noise. It's like trying to run a marathon after you've already walked 10 miles.
Let me map what we're describing. You've got the amygdala firing unpredictably all day. The prefrontal cortex unable to regulate it. Central sensitization making everything worse over time. A constant cognitive tax from listening effort. And underneath it all, the psychological weight of knowing you can't escape for another year. That's not a noise problem. That's a sustained neurological assault.
The vibration component, at 125 Hz, adds another layer. Low-frequency sound transmits through building structures very efficiently. Your body detects vibration through mechanoreceptors in your skin and proprioceptors in your muscles and joints. These signals converge on the same brainstem regions that process auditory startle. So you're getting a double hit, sound through your ears and vibration through your body, both triggering the same threat detection circuitry.
I want to sit with something you said about the orienting response. You mentioned it's an ancient circuit.
Deeply conserved across mammals. The basic architecture, auditory signal to amygdala to cortisol release, exists in essentially every mammal we've studied. This isn't a higher cognitive process. It's happening in brain regions that evolved hundreds of millions of years before the prefrontal cortex showed up, which is why, just relax, is such fundamentally useless advice. You're asking the newest part of your brain to override one of the oldest parts, and the older part has a much faster connection.
When Marcus says he feels like he's going crazy, what he's actually describing is his ancient threat detection system doing exactly what it evolved to do, just in a context where the threat is a construction site that poses no actual physical danger.
That's precisely it. The system is working correctly. The problem is the mismatch between the environment it evolved for and the environment it's operating in. A sudden loud noise in our ancestral environment almost always meant something dangerous. A predator, a rockfall, an aggressive conspecific. The brain's response is calibrated for those stakes. It can't tell the difference between a leopard and a jackhammer, and because the jackhammer keeps being unpredictable, it can't learn that it's not a leopard.
This also explains something Marcus didn't explicitly ask, but that I think is lurking in his question. Why does the noise feel worse in the afternoon than in the morning, even if the decibel level is the same?
The cortisol staircase effect. Each unpredictable noise burst spikes your cortisol. Cortisol has a metabolic half-life. Your body clears it, but it takes time. When the bursts come faster than your clearance rate, your baseline cortisol never returns to normal between spikes. By early afternoon, you're starting from an elevated baseline, and each new spike pushes you higher. The same noise at 2 p.m. feels subjectively worse than at 9 a.m. because your stress physiology is already primed.
If this goes on for months, you're essentially living with chronically elevated cortisol, which has its own cascade. Sleep disruption, immune suppression, increased blood pressure, impaired glucose regulation. And construction noise specifically fragments sleep because of anticipatory arousal. If you know the noise starts at 7 a.m., your brain starts waking you up at 6,000 3D to prepare. You're losing sleep even before the noise begins.
Marcus mentioned he's in Jerusalem, a city that's basically one continuous construction site right now. Light rail expansion, new residential towers, infrastructure projects everywhere. He's not alone. Rapidly developing cities worldwide are facing this exact problem. Seoul, Singapore, Dubai, Tel Aviv, anywhere with dense urban construction, you've got thousands of people living adjacent to active sites. And the research shows this exact scenario, unpredictable intermittent noise with no escape, creates the highest psychological distress scores of any common urban noise exposure. Worse than traffic, aircraft, or trains, because all of those are at least somewhat predictable.
Trains run on schedules. Planes follow flight paths. Traffic has rush hour patterns. A jackhammer is just.
That whenever is the entire problem. Your brain can build a predictive model of train noise. It can learn that the 8:15 is coming and then it's gone. It cannot build a predictive model of hydraulic rock breaking because there is no pattern to model. The operator takes a break. The rock is harder in one spot. The machine needs repositioning. The randomness is inherent to the work.
We've established that this is hard, that the suffering has a measurable neurobiological basis, and that getting used to it is not a thing that happens. Where do we go from there?
That's where the environmental psychology literature gets interesting. Because while most people don't habituate, there is a subset who cope successfully, and the research has identified what they do differently. But before we get to strategies, I want to make one more point about why this particular sound profile is so invasive. Marcus's measurements show energy concentrated between 125 Hz and 2 kHz. That range covers the fundamental frequencies of human speech. So the construction noise isn't just loud, it's competing directly with the frequencies your brain uses to understand language. That's why it feels like it's cutting through everything. It literally is cutting through the most important acoustic information your brain processes.
68 decibels indoors means you're getting about a 13 decibel signal to noise ratio if someone's speaking at a normal conversational level. Below 15, even people with normal hearing start to miss words. Below 10, conversation becomes effortful. At 13, you're right on the edge.
To summarize where we are before we dig into solutions, Marcus is living with a stressor that triggers an ancient threat response his brain can't habituate to, that gets subjectively worse over time due to central sensitization, that imposes a constant hidden cognitive tax on speech comprehension, that elevates his cortisol baseline across the day, and that he can't escape for another year because of a lease signed under different circumstances. That's not annoying. That's a genuine psychological endurance event.
I think naming it that way is actually the first step toward coping. The research shows that people who understand what's happening in their brain are better at managing it. When you know that the afternoon rage you're feeling is cortisol accumulation rather than personal weakness, it changes how you relate to the experience. You stop blaming yourself for not being tough enough, and start working with your biology instead of against it. Let's start with the paradox that explains why this feels so much worse than traffic noise, the orienting response, one of the oldest circuits in the mammalian brain. When a sound changes unexpectedly, your auditory cortex sends an immediate signal to the amygdala, which triggers a cortisol release before you've even consciously registered what you heard. We're talking 12 to 15 milliseconds. You're already stressed before you know why.
Traffic doesn't do this because it's continuous. The brain treats a steady drone as background. It stops checking. Continuous noise allows habituation. The orienting response diminishes because the stimulus becomes predictable. but intermittent, unpredictable noise prevents habituation entirely. Each jackhammer burst is a fresh surprise. Each one triggers a new cortisol spike. The 2019 Environmental Health Perspectives study quantified this directly. Intermittent noise causes 2 to 3 times more subjective annoyance than continuous noise at the same average decibel level. The mechanism, unpredictability, prevents the prefrontal cortex from downregulating the amygdala's threat response. Normally, your prefrontal cortex can send inhibitory signals telling the amygdala to stand down. But that circuit requires predictability to engage. When the noise is random, the prefrontal cortex can't get a grip.
You've got the ancient threat detector firing over and over, and the rational part of your brain that's supposed to calm it down is just standing there with nothing to work with.
Here's where it gets worse, central sensitization. With chronic intermittent noise, the neural pathways for threat detection don't just fail to habituate, they actually strengthen. The synapses become more efficient at transmitting the alarm signal. The threshold for triggering the stress response drops lower and lower. By month 3 or 4, you're reacting more intensely to the same noise than you did in week 1. The longitudinal data confirms this. A 2020 study tracked residents near construction sites over 6 months, and annoyance scores actually increased before plateauing. People weren't adapting. They were sensitizing. The startle reflex, that involuntary muscle contraction when a loud sound hits, doesn't diminish with repeated exposure to unpredictable noise. It gets faster and stronger. Your body is literally bracing harder over time.
Walk me through what this looks like across a single day.
The cortisol staircase. Each unpredictable jackhammer burst spikes cortisol. Cortisol has a metabolic half-life, so your body clears it gradually. But when the bursts come faster than your clearance rate, your baseline never returns to normal between spikes. By early afternoon, you're starting from an elevated baseline. The same decibel level that was merely irritating at 9 in the morning now feels distressing at 2 in the afternoon. And each new spike pushes you higher from that elevated starting point. You're climbing a staircase of stress physiology all day.
If this goes on for months, that chronic elevation has its own cascade. Sleep fragmentation, immune suppression, elevated blood pressure, impaired glucose regulation. Construction noise specifically fragments sleep through anticipatory arousal. If you know the jackhammers start at 7, your brain starts waking you at 6:30 to prepare. You're losing sleep even before the noise begins. I want to connect this to something Marcus mentioned, the indoor measurement. 68 decibels. That's in the range where speech intelligibility degrades.
This is a hidden cognitive tax. When background noise hits about 65 to 70 decibels, your brain has to work significantly harder to parse conversation. Researchers call this listening effort, a measurable drain on working memory and attention. By the end of a day of intermittent construction noise, you've accumulated hours of this extra cognitive load. Your brain has been running a background process all day just to understand what people are saying. If you're trying to write, code, or think deeply, you're doing it with a brain that's already partially depleted.
There's another piece that connects directly to Marcus's situation. Seligman's learned helplessness research. When someone perceives they have no control over an aversive stimulus, they eventually stop trying to escape even when escape becomes possible. Marcus signed a lease before the work intensified. He made a reasonable decision, circumstances changed, and now he's locked in for a year. That's the perfect setup for this psychological trap.
Learned helplessness doesn't just affect your response to the noise. You start bracing for the next burst even during quiet periods. You stop trying things that might help because your brain has learned that effort doesn't matter. The passivity becomes the default. That's why the coping strategies we're about to discuss aren't just about comfort. They're about preventing that slide into helplessness.
One comparison before we move to solutions. A 2022 study on wind turbine noise. Continuous low-frequency sound. Found annoyance, yes, but not the same hypervigilance, not the same sleep fragmentation, not the same startle reflex sensitization. The difference is entirely in the temporal structure. Continuous noise, even when loud, doesn't hijack the orienting response the way intermittent impulsive noise does.
Which is actually a hopeful point, because it means the problem isn't just loudness, it's the specific pattern of unpredictability. And if the pattern is the problem, creating predictability where you can is part of the solution. That's where we're headed next. what the people who cope successfully actually do differently, and why small acts of control matter disproportionately when your brain is stuck in threat detection mode. If habituation is unlikely, and the evidence says for most people it is, what do the people who cope well actually do differently? The environmental psychology literature has identified three factors that consistently distinguish successful copers from people who just endure and deteriorate: perceived control over the environment, cognitive reappraisal of what the noise means, and active coping strategies versus passive endurance. And the order matters. Perceived control is the foundation. Everything else builds on it.
Let's start there. What does perceived control actually look like when you can't control the noise itself?
This is where the research gets surprisingly practical. A 2021 intervention study in Seoul gave residents near construction sites access to a single sound-treated room in their building. Not a professional recording studio, just a room with some acoustic treatment that reduced the noise by about 15 decibels. Reported stress dropped 37%. Not because the noise went away, because people knew they had somewhere to go. The brain can relax the hypervigilance when it knows a sanctuary exists, even if you're not in it at that moment.
It's almost like an escape hatch you don't have to use. The mere existence of the option changes the threat calculation.
That's exactly the mechanism. The amygdala isn't just responding to the noise, it's responding to the assessment of, I'm trapped with this. When your brain updates that assessment to, I have a refuge available, the threat response dials down. Having a single quiet room, even if it's imperfect, even if you only use it occasionally, reduces overall annoyance by 30 to 40%. The mechanism is specifically about breaking the learned helplessness loop. You're not passively enduring. You have a move you can make.
Which means for Marcus, designating one room as the quiet zone, even if it's just the bedroom with some extra soft furnishings and a door seal, isn't just about acoustic comfort. It's a psychological intervention.
The research suggests you should be deliberate about it. Actually designate it. Tell yourself, this is the sanctuary room. Keep it as a no-construction thought zone. When you're in there, you're not monitoring for the next jackhammer burst. You're not checking the clock to see how many hours of noise are left. You're training your nervous system that this space is different.
The second factor, cognitive reappraisal. This sounds dangerously close to just think positive, which is exactly the kind of advice Marcus said he doesn't want.
It's different, and the neuroscience backs this up. Cognitive reappraisal isn't about pretending the noise isn't bothersome. It's about deliberately shifting what the noise means to you. fMRI studies of emotion regulation show that when people consciously reframe a negative stimulus, changing their interpretation of what it signifies, the prefrontal cortex activates and sends inhibitory signals to the amygdala within about 90 seconds. It's not toxic positivity, it's a deliberate neural pathway shift.
Give me a concrete example.
There was a study of residents near the Crossrail project in London, massive tunnel boring and excavation that went on for years. One group viewed the noise as an invasion of my home. The other group had been primed to view it as the sound of the city improving. Infrastructure being built, progress happening, temporary disruption for long-term benefit. The second group had significantly lower cortisol levels, same decibel levels.
When the jackhammer starts, you're not telling yourself, this is fine. You're telling yourself something specific, like this is the sound of the foundation being poured for a building that will outlast me. That's a different cognitive operation than denial.
The specificity matters. Vague positivity doesn't engage the prefrontal cortex's reappraisal circuit the same way. The reframe needs to be concrete and believable to you. For Marcus in Jerusalem, something like this is the sound of Jerusalem growing, or this excavation is the worst phase, and once the foundation is in, the noise profile changes. That second one is particularly powerful because it's true. The excavation and rock-breaking phase is the worst. Foundation pouring and superstructure construction produce more continuous, lower-impact noise that's actually easier to habituate to.
Which connects to the third factor, active coping versus passive endurance. What does active coping look like day-to-day?
The temporal structure strategy is one of the most effective. Research on shift workers and noise exposure shows that predictable schedules of exposure reduce stress even when total exposure time is identical. The brain can prepare for known stressors. It can't prepare for random ones. So one of the most practical things Marcus can do is find out exactly when the heavy machinery operates. Most construction sites have predictable rhythms. Rock breaking might happen between 8 and 11, then again from 1 to 4. Call the site manager.
There's actual research showing this works.
There's a study where residents near construction sites receive daily text updates about when heavy machinery would be operating. Just a text message. Jackhammering expected 8 a.m. to noon today. Those residents reported 25% less annoyance than residents who got no schedule information. Same noise exposure. The only difference was knowing when it would happen.
You're replacing when will it start? When will it stop? Is it going to go all day? That constant low-grade scanning. With a known window. The brain can budget its resources around a known window.
That's exactly what reduces the cognitive load. You can plan deep work for the quiet hours. You can schedule calls for when you know the noise will be minimal. You can stop bracing for the next burst during the scheduled quiet periods because you know it's not coming. The predictability doesn't change the decibels, but it fundamentally changes how your brain processes them.
I want to talk about masking, because this is where a lot of people reach for white noise machines, and then get frustrated when they don't work.
White noise is the wrong tool for this specific sound profile. White noise has equal energy per frequency. It's flat across the spectrum. But Marcus's measurements show the construction noise is concentrated between 125 Hz and 2 kHz, with a lot of energy in the low-mid range. Pink noise has equal energy per octave, which means it has more power in the lower frequencies. It better masks the specific spectral profile of rock breaking and hydraulic hammering.
Pink noise covers the bass-heavy thud and rumble that white noise leaves exposed.
And you want to set it at about 55 to 60 decibels. Loud enough to mask, but not so loud it becomes its own stressor. The goal isn't to drown out the construction noise completely. At 68 decibels coming through the walls, you're not going to eliminate it with a sound machine. The goal is to reduce the contrast between the background and the noise peaks. When the jackhammer hits, the jump from 55 decibels of pink noise to 68 is less jarring than the jump from 30 decibels of silence to 68. Your orienting response is triggered by change, not by absolute level. Reducing the magnitude of change reduces the startle.
That's a useful reframe. You're not trying to make the construction noise inaudible. You're trying to make it less surprising.
That loops right back to predictability. The pink noise creates a more stable acoustic floor. The construction noise becomes a variation on that floor rather than an intrusion into silence.
Let me try to pull all of this into something Marcus can actually use tomorrow morning. Three buckets: predictability, sanctuary, restoration. The research points to these as the active ingredients, and the order matters.
Start with predictability, because it's the one that directly counteracts what we've been describing about the orienting response. Get the construction schedule, call the site foreman, or walk over and ask. Most sites have predictable rhythms. Rock breaking and morning blocks, quieter periods for debris clearing, lunch breaks. Write it down. Make a weekly map. The study I mentioned, daily text updates about heavy machinery timing. Cut reported annoyance by 25%. Marcus can create that for himself without waiting for anyone to send him a text.
The point isn't just knowing when the noise will happen, it's knowing when it won't. Those quiet windows are where you schedule anything requiring focus. Deep work, calls, anything where listening effort matters. Your brain can budget its resources when it knows the boundaries.
Second bucket is sanctuary. Designate one room. Doesn't have to be perfect, doesn't need professional acoustic treatment. The Seoul study got a 37% stress reduction with just 15 decibels of reduction. Add soft surfaces. Hang heavy curtains. Put a door seal on. Run pink noise at 55 to 60 decibels. Not white noise, pink noise, because its spectral distribution actually covers that 125 Hz to 2 kHz band where the rock breaking energy sits. And here's the key. Treat this room as a no-construction thought zone. When you're in there, you're not monitoring for the next burst. You're not checking the clock. You're training your nervous system that this space is different.
Third bucket is restoration. 20 minutes minimum of deliberate quiet exposure daily. And ideally not just quiet, but a natural soundscape. Birdsong, water, wind and trees. Research on auditory restoration shows natural sounds specifically reduce sympathetic nervous system activation after noise exposure. It resets what's called auditory gain, your ear's sensitivity adjustment that gets stuck on high alert after hours of unpredictable noise.
A park bench. a library reading room, even a quiet cafe during off hours. The mechanism isn't just taking a break. It's giving your auditory system a known clean signal so it can recalibrate. 20 minutes is enough. The research shows the effect kicks in reliably at about 15 to 20 minutes of natural quiet exposure.
No, the cognitive reframe. When the jackhammer starts, consciously say to yourself something like, "This is the sound of the building going up, not the sound of my home being invaded." That exact phrasing matters. You're not saying it's pleasant. You're changing what the sound signifies. fMRI studies show this kind of deliberate reappraisal activates the prefrontal cortex's regulatory connection to the amygdala within about 90 seconds. It's not denial. It's a neural circuit you're deliberately engaging.
For Marcus specifically, there's a reframe that has the added benefit of being true. The excavation phase is the worst. Rock breaking, hydraulic hammering. That's the impulsive, unpredictable, low-frequency assault. Once the foundation is poured, the noise profile shifts. Superstructure construction is more continuous, still loud, but the temporal pattern changes to something the brain can actually begin to habituate to. So, this is the worst it will ever be, and it's time-limited, is both accurate and useful as a reappraisal.
I want to name something we haven't said explicitly. There are warning signs that what you're experiencing has moved past normal coping difficulty into something that warrants professional support. Four specific ones. First, you find yourself bracing for the next noise even during quiet periods. That's hypervigilance, and it means your nervous system has stopped distinguishing between threat and safety. Second, you stop wanting to be in your apartment even when it's quiet. Your brain has tagged home as a threat environment. Third, you feel angry or tearful about the noise daily after 3 or more months. That's emotional dysregulation from chronic stress. Fourth, your sleep quality has measurably declined, not just waking up when the noise starts, but waking up before it in anticipation. That's sleep fragmentation from anticipatory arousal, and it has its own health consequences.
Any one of those is worth paying attention to. Two or more, and the research suggests it's time to talk to someone. A psychologist, a stress specialist, even a GP who can assess what chronic cortisol elevation might be doing. This isn't weakness. It's recognizing that sustained neurological stress has real physiological consequences that sometimes need clinical support.
One last thing, and I think this is hopeful. Research on temporal framing shows that people tolerate intermittent stressors about 40% better when they can visualize an end date. That's enormous. Create a visual countdown. Not to the end of the lease. To the end of the excavation phase. Because that's the phase that's doing the neurological damage we've been describing. Foundation work has an endpoint. Concrete gets poured. The rock breakers go away. The noise doesn't stop. But it changes into something your brain can actually work with.
That shift from "I'm trapped for a year" to "the hardest part has a specific end date and I can mark it on a calendar." That's not just psychological, that's changing the threat assessment your amygdala is running. The brain processes "this will end on a known date" completely differently than "this will go on indefinitely." Same remaining duration. Completely different stress profile.
Here's where we land. You can't control the jackhammer. You can't control the site schedule, or the lease, or the fact that Jerusalem is basically one continuous excavation right now. But the research is unambiguous. Perceived control, even in small doses, is the single strongest predictor of who stays psychologically intact through this and who doesn't. And perceived control isn't about actually controlling the noise. It's about having moves you can make. A quiet room you can retreat to. A schedule you can plan around. A reframe you can deploy. A countdown you can see.
That's the thread that runs through everything we've discussed. The Seoul study with the sound-treated room, people didn't even have to be in it to get the benefit. Just knowing it existed changed their stress profile. The construction schedule study, a text message saying when the noise would happen, cut annoyance by a quarter. These aren't massive interventions. They're small acts of agency that tell your amygdala something it desperately needs to hear. You are not trapped.
We've covered what the research says works. But I want to open this up. If you're listening and you've lived through something like this, months of unpredictable construction noise with no way out, what actually helped? The podcast community has a way of surfacing creative solutions that the academic literature hasn't captured yet. We'd like to hear them.
Marcus, I want to close with something that I think is easy to miss when you're in the middle of it. You sent us decibel measurements. You specified the frequency range. You asked about neurobiology and environmental psychology and evidence-based coping strategies rather than generic advice. That is itself a coping strategy. You're not passively suffering. You're actively trying to understand what's happening to your brain and what you can do about it. The research shows that information-seeking and problem-focused coping are protective factors in their own right. You're already doing the hardest part.
No, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1980s, a short-lived theory in Seychelles Sepak Takraw circles held that the ideal surf trajectory followed the golden ratio, 1.618, relative to the net height, a claim that dominated regional coaching manuals for nearly 4 years before being demolished by a single high-speed photography study that showed the actual ratio was closer to 1.3.
I have so many questions, and I'm going to ask none of them.
The golden ratio shows up in the strangest places. Or doesn't, as it turns out.
This has been my Weird Prompts, with thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, and a special thanks to Marcus James for sending us this one. If you've got a question that's been rattling around your brain, construction noise or otherwise, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.